Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Cristiano Ronaldo returns to the Premier League this weekend on Optus Sport. And as we count down to his comeback at Manchester United, we speak to two gentlemen who have played against him, against Manchester United, and can tell us what it is like when the Ronaldo circus rolls into town. A huge episode of the Gaggenpod coming up, Premier League, international, Socceroos, and so much more. Let's get started. Yes, hi everyone. Welcome back to another episode of the Gaggenpod. Hopefully everyone's recharged from a weekend of no Premier League, except hopefully you've enjoyed our full offering of international football. We're almost there through, I think, a week of 75 matches in about 8 days with one more set of qualifiers to come. A tasty day on Thursday, by the way, with a lot of the big nations playing. But we're going to run through all of that on today's episode of the Gaggenpod. David Wiener with you here once again to do so. As Cristiano Ronaldo, he was rested from Portugal's final game as he returned to Manchester United training for the first time in over a decade. We're going to touch on that, of course, today as well and run through some of the key results from international football before we start to preview the return of the Premier League. To do so today, I am joined by Mark Schwarzer over in Spain, Thomas Sorensen in Melbourne. Gents, great to see you both. Schwarzy, how are you? Nice and tanned on our Zoom call as well, making Thomas and I look like snowmen. But nevertheless, we will plow on. Good to see you. What's happening in your world?
Well, just enjoying the sun, mate. Like you said, nicely tanned. And there's been no effort. I have to say, there's been no effort to go out there and get a tan. It just happened organically. Just the weather's so good. Yeah, exactly. Food, wine, goes without saying, is absolutely brilliant. And the beer's not bad either.
Thomas, how's your block looking? That's about as what we can talk about. You walk around the block, you're getting a few miles in the legs.
Oh, I like the little smirk he got in there at the end of it. I can say I'm sitting here with a bit of jealousy, we'll get there soon. So everyone out there, get vaccinated so we can open this thing up and get live sport, because like watching all these games, fantastic to see fan bases all around the world getting excited, and we want to get excited here as well. So it'll be soon, hopefully.
100%. Well, we've got that to talk about. Football, as we say, is what's been keeping us very busy. And for the listeners out there, Thomas is proudly wearing his Denmark shirt again that we saw through the Euros, which is great to see. And that's because they won 5-0 over Israel this morning. They're flying in World Cup qualifying in Denmark. Thomas, they haven't conceded a goal, well clear in Group F. Interestingly, that's a little bit tighter than it might have been, because Lyndon Dykes, he scored a winner for Scotland, 1-0 over Austria. So the Australian-born striker still doing the business there over in Europe in international arena. Other results on Wednesday as we record this podcast is Netherlands. They had a big win, 6-1 over Turkey. Memphis Depay scoring a treble. That's an interesting one because it was the reverse fixture that actually had a lot of people tipping Turkey as dark horses for the Euros before the tournament earlier this year. So their form has fallen away. And the Dutch under Louis van Gaal, they needed that because Norway, they're neck and neck with them in their group as well. Erling Braut Haaland, no surprise, he scored this morning as well. France, Antoine Griezmann's show there. He moved level with Michel Platini with a brace in a 2-0 win over Finland. He's 10 shy of Thierry Henry's record for their country. Now, as I mentioned, Ronaldo was rested, but there was no problem for Portugal. They eased past Azerbaijan, Bruno Fernandes and Bernardo Silva combining beautifully for a goal. And Ireland, in that group, they pulled one back late to draw 1-1 with Serbia. And that was an interesting and important late development because that allowed Portugal to move 2 points clear in their group. That's quite tight with Serbia breathing down their necks. That was an important development for the Portuguese. Around the grounds, France and Denmark, they're pretty comfortable. But Thursday's matches present an interesting set of fixtures because Spain, they have Sweden breathing down their necks in their group. Italy, even though they've notched 36 straight undefeated, they have Switzerland on their trail. So both those nations need to get the results they need. Belgium face Belarus. They're pretty comfortable in a group with Czech Republic breathing down their neck. And England and Germany, who we'll touch on in detail in a moment, they're in control, but need to take care of results against Poland and Iceland, respectively, to make sure that their group remains firmly and comfortably in their hands. So, gents, to you both, because there's been so many matches and everyone's got different things they're going to be noticing from this fixture deluge. What's taken your fancy, Schwartzy? What's the result, the performance, the trend that has caught your eye from the internationals in UEFA?
Well, I think the two of them is really, you mentioned there briefly, Italy, kind of limping over the line, you know, like drawing the last couple of games, and obviously going on to this incredible record of their own. So it's pretty harsh on me to point out Italy, but it's just one of those ones where you just kind of go, are they at the verge of the point now where they're going to drop point, where they're going to lose game, they're going to lose a game. Will they break the record and then go on a run of losing a couple of games? You just don't know. You wouldn't think so with the quality they have. France is probably the biggest problem child at the moment. There seems to be a lot of unrest. There's a lot of murmurs out there, a lot of stories sort of kind of surfacing. Supposedly, Deschamps has lost the plot. Benzema has caused ripples within the camp, and Griezmann hasn't been firing and is a bit of a problem for them. I know he did score two overnight, but it just seems to be at the moment the French side. There was also obviously talk of during the Euros issues between family members of players fighting in the stands. So that's never a good sign. And generally when there's a lot of talk about it, where there's smoke, there's fire, as they say, and it seems to be the case with the French.
The French one's an interesting, Thomas, because obviously Deschamps did so incredibly at the World Cup, a good organizer of men. But the moment there was that question about what was France's style of play, what are they beyond a collection of the most dazzling individuals you could probably assemble in international football? And maybe in this period here, we're starting to see a few of those problems arise, particularly as he's had to try and integrate all those players Schwartzy mentioned, with Benzema coming in and almost overcomplicating things because you've almost got now too many stars to try and accommodate. Do you think, because the rumour was after the Euros that Zidane might have been lurking, they've stuck with Deschamps, but do you think this might be an ongoing theme heading towards the World Cup?
You know, I think France are a little bit in the same boat as Germany was under Joachim Löw. You know, there's just a bit of tiredness in there. I think, you know, tactically, a little bit too pragmatic. I think we saw it during the Euros as well. You know, and it is about managing players because they've got abundance of talent. You know, Benzema, I thought it was a good decision because I thought he could just add something else to it. But you know, if there is unrest in behind the scenes, is he then worth it? He did well. He scored some good goals at the Euros and made a difference. But longer term, you know, then you have to look at those things. And you could see what happens with the German squad when Flick is now in. They just look to be, you know, playing with a smile on their faces, a different energy, a little bit of a different tactical approach. And it just looks a little bit like France needs some of that as well.
Yep, that's an interesting one. Italy's an interesting one too, because it's such a level they had during the Euros. There might be that inevitable drop-off, but they just do have to be a little bit careful because Switzerland, 4 points behind, they got two games in hand. So Italy just have to be a little bit careful and make sure they keep winning those matches, stay ahead. And I think they play each other towards the back end, and that's going to be almost a six-pointer to secure that top spot for the group. Now, your nation, Thomas, everyone called them the fairy tale at the Euros for, you know, we know why now because of the context of the tournament and what happened, but that might have just been unfair in terms of the fact that your nation is on clearly an upward trajectory, and that seems to have continued after the competition.
Yeah, no, they're looking really good. They got a very strong squad, especially defensively, all the way through the spine, like from Schmeichel at the back here, Christensen, Delaney, Højbjerg, now Damsgaard is, you know, he's followed the form up. I think maybe up front, you know, the last couple of qualifiers, they were without Braithwaite and Dolberg, so and still managed to score plenty of goals. So, but you know, looking at the group, it's not, you know, it's not the best of groups. And Austria, who actually did pretty well at the Euros, have totally fallen off the cliff and it's been absolutely shocking. So, you know, it might just be a little bit of, you know, we can't get too carried away with it. But yeah, they're definitely looking good and winning the games they have to win. And again, bringing through some talent as well, because when they played in Faroe Islands a couple of games ago, you know, they played with a second string, a lot of debutants and you know, that looks to be, you know, some good players coming through after as well, which is exciting.
One group I didn't mention was Group H, where Croatia, they won 3-0 this morning against Slovenia. They needed that too, because they're level on 13 points with Russia. So you talk about the Denmark group being pretty clear. That's a group that's going to go right down to the wire. The Netherlands one is interesting. I just wanted to survey you guys on Louis van Gaal's reappointment as Dutch boss. That one caught me by surprise because, I mean, I guess the Dutch, they do have their way of doing things. But after going, it's almost like they were so shook by Frank de Boer's tactics and what he tried to do at the Euros, and it's been so long since they were really at the level they want to be. You probably got to go back to 2014 when there was Van Gaal in charge. They've pulled him out of retirement, Schwartz. He was busy, you know, smoking cigars with Huss Hiddink, doing whatever these guys do when they retire, and now he's back in the dugout and looking to get his nation back where they ought to be.
Well, according to him himself, it's like, of course, he was the natural replacement. He's the one that they had to turn to because he's the one that's going to save them. Listen, if he leads them to the World Cup, then it certainly would have paid off. And of course, you know, the result against Turkey, I mean, it is a really good result. We know Turkey certainly were very underwhelming, underperformed at the Euros. And they've continued that now. They did have a player sent off, Suunchai, just around the half-time mark. And obviously that basically sealed their fate. But at the time, I think it was already 3-0. So they were heading in a bad direction anyway. Obviously, a lot is not right with the Turkish side. But Holland, the positives are there. And obviously the change of the manager. I think the ruthlessness of Van Gaal seems to be paying off, and obviously the slightly confident nature of the manager, I think, is probably rubbed off on his players.
I remember an anecdote that before Bert van Marwijk was appointed for the Socceroos, I think Van Gaal was talked to, and I think he told the Australian party that was talking to him, well, you need me more than I need you, so tell me why I should come.
I think there's been a lot of international managers who said that to Australia over the years, and he wouldn't have been the first nor probably the last.
True that. Looking ahead, guys, I mentioned the England group. They go to Poland, which is a tricky fixture. They negotiated the Hungary part of this triple header last week, but they go to Poland now to, again, as I said, get control of their group. But it was an interesting experiment by Gareth Southgate at Wembley against Andorra. And if you're going to experiment, you do it against a side ranked 156th in a World Cup qualifier, Thomas. But it's what all of England are talking about in terms of connecting England with the Premier League right now. And that's Trent Alexander-Arnold playing in midfield alongside Jordan Henderson and Jude Bellingham in that game. He himself has said afterwards he found it difficult getting on the ball, finding the right spaces. What did you make of that experiment? Because it's one that a few people have called on for a while. Do you think in a way it almost ends the myth that just because he's a brilliant right back that he should make that migration to midfield, he can actually be at his very best currently where he right is?
You know, I think it shows that even though, you know, you're looking at his game, you know, he's got the passing range, he's got the energy, he's dynamic, you know, he's got a great view for the game. But you know, at the top level, it takes craft, hard work to learn every single position. And, you know, we've seen it in the past. You know, we've seen, you know, Kimmich, Philipp Lahm, who sort of moved from that right back, left back into midfield and had done really well. But it's taken him years at Bayern Munich to do that. And yeah, I think it stems from the problem is that he's far down the pecking order at that right-hand spot. You've got Kyle Walker, Rhys James, Trippier is there. And he's a good player. You know, we've seen it at Liverpool, you know, how many assists he's given up, contributing. So you're trying to fit him in, but I think defensively he's maybe not as strong as the others and that's letting him down. And I think it's just desperation from Southgate trying to find a solution to get him and keep him in the squad, because otherwise, why is he there if he's only third, fourth choice at his natural position?
What did you make of it, Schwartzy?
For me, it reeked of really picking a player that is a phenomenal right back, like Thomas was saying. And obviously, Gareth has made a decision on who he wants to play at right back, and Reece James and Kyle Walker are ahead of Alexander-Arnold in the pecking order. So I think it's got a lot to do with the pressure from the outside world, from the media, from the fans, and he's trying to find an alternative solution for Alexander-Arnold. And it kind of reminded me a little bit of back in the time when Frank Lampard and Steven Gerrard, both incredible midfield players, but for some reason or another, it just didn't quite work as a pairing within the England national team. And I actually don't think it was just them. I think it was an overall combination of the whole team. I think the dynamics and the chemistry of the team wasn't right. It wasn't just them too. It sort of kind of reeks of that, being afraid to leave one or the other out. And I think it's the same with Alexander-Arnold. There's almost a fear of leaving him out because he's so good as a right back, and no one can believe he's not in the England side. But I think Gareth just needs to make the decision. He needs to decide on, right, I'm either gonna pick him as a right back, or I'm gonna leave him out and pick another midfield player and pick a player that's specialised in that position. Listen, he struggled against Andorra, and that is nowhere near the level that's going to be needed to play at a World Cup, to go beyond, to go anywhere. So it's not going to happen for him against a better opponent. He's best positioned by far and above is it right back, right wing back, whatever you want to say. And that's what he should be picked for.
It's interesting because in that game, Reece James from right back had more touches than Alexander-Arnold did in midfield. So it just shows you how specialist it is, and you can't just, even at international level against a minnow, go into that position. But I guess, Tom, it's a little bit instructive of Southgate, just the personality of the team he's going to pick, because he's gone to the two players that you both mentioned, James and Walker, who are inherently, people would argue, better pure defenders than Alexander-Arnold. But the threat that Alexander-Arnold delivers from right back is just so compelling. But it also just shows like how much things have changed. A right back can be an influential part of your team from an attacking sense, that he does not have to be in midfield to have that influence.
No, I think the Euros were a perfect example. You know, some of the outstanding performances came from wing backs. You know, we had Dumfries obviously burst onto the scene. We had Joachim Mele from the Danish team. You know, so it's become especially now when the tactical change to that, you know, back three with wing backs, you know, they've become really, really crucial in going forward. And obviously have to have great engines, but defensively they also have to be able to do a job. I think it's a little bit of a picture of how Southgate thinks tactically as well. You know, he is a little bit defensive. You know, he loves to secure the back line, and he's maybe not willing to take that, you know, X factor effect that Trent Alexander-Arnold has going forward, you know, that he shows for Liverpool. Maybe he hasn't got the same, you know, security, you know, with obviously a Van Dijk, at that back line that he feels is enough to have Arnold in the team.
The question I would suppose you would have to ask, and Gareth would have to answer, is Alexander-Arnold that much better than Reece James and Kyle Walker going forward? And are Reece James and Kyle Walker that much better than Alexander-Arnold defensively? And then, so what kind of cancels out one or the other? You know, what's the importance? See, I think Reece James and Kyle Walker going forward are exceptionally good. Are they good as Alexander-Arnold? Probably not. But are they miles off him? No. I think the margin is minimal. Are they better defenders than Alexander-Arnold? Yes. I think that margin is more significant. And I think that's probably more the reason why he would pick Reece James and Walker ahead of Alexander-Arnold in that position. I think for Reece James, there were a lot of question marks still out about whether or not defensively he was capable enough. I think there's almost one game that was a defining moment for him so far early in his career. And that for me was the Champions League final. Mm. I think he proved in that final at the one, you know, that certainly in a club level, the highest level, he can perform at an exceptional level defensively and have a major contribution to his side. And I think Chilwell was exactly the same on the other side as well. But I think Reece James, that was one of the big reasons why he almost cemented a position in that England squad.
Yeah,
we got to be honest. Like, Trent Alexander-Arnold will get in any national team around the world. He's just playing for the country where there's two exceptional people in front of him.
Well, that's the running joke, is that England could field an 11 of right backs. With the punchline that Kyle Walker would be in goals because of that cameo for Manchester City. So that's the punchline. They have extraordinary depth when you consider that Aaron Wan-Bissaka isn't even in the discussion.
But I also feel sorry for Kieran Trippier, because he's playing as a left back and his strongest position is a right back, and he's a phenomenal right back. So I have sympathy for him, and I actually feel sorry for him, because you're not really getting the true Kieran Trippier at right back.
Yeah, and he's being, and he's sort of the benefit of him going to play with Diego Simeone is his, you know, defensive knowledge and know-how, but he's being shoehorned into another position because of that, you know, that craft that he's learned over in Spain.
Which because he went there, yeah, exactly, because he went there and experienced that, he's able to do it. Whereas prior to going to Spain, Gareth Southgate probably never in a million years would have looked at putting Trippier as a left back.
Good to have options. You know who's got options now all of a sudden is Germany. 6-0 win over Armenia. You read into that what you will, but probably the panache and the energy they played with. We'll get a better glimpse against Iceland on Thursday. But I know you follow the national team of Germany with intrigue, Mark. Obviously, Hansi Flick's now in charge. And this looked a lot more like the start of a fresh new era.
Oh, yeah. And Germany's been crying out for probably... Certainly, the last year, the Euros and the World Cup, in for me in Russia, I think I said it before that the change came way too long, late. However, it is what it is. And I think the key to this is Hansi Flick at the moment is, I think, found a good balance between really good experienced players and the emerging youth and giving youth an opportunity. The fact that he was at Bayern Munich, and he's had the opportunities to bring through players like Jamal Musiala, who I think is a sensational player, someone that seems to take it in his stride, the jump from being a B team player at Bayern Munich to an important squad player to playing, you know, a handful of games in a row for them, to now also being involved in a national team with Germany, the full national team. I think it's absolutely brilliant. Florian Wirtz, same thing, you know, from Bayer Leverkusen, the creative midfield player under Jogi Löw. I thought Musiala, this is the thing, you know, you look at the Euros, Musiala came on against England with about 3 or 4 minutes to go. They're chasing the game. For me, that's a substitution that clearly was just the case of he was probably told he had to bring in these young players and give them a bit of an exposure and experience at the Euros. But he didn't really believe in it and didn't want to give them that opportunity. He stuck with the tried and tested. And I think he had too much faith in players and loyalty to players, which you want to have as a manager, or you certainly as a player want that from a manager. But I think he took him too far, and that was, in the end, his undoing. But now under Hansi Flick, he's got an opportunity to wipe the slate clean. You know, Kroos announces retirement, Hummels moves on, and he's able to, you know, to bring players into the squad. And you look at Thomas Müller, who obviously was at the Euros, but Hansi Flick revitalized him at Bayern Munich. And there is such an incredible relationship between the two. So I think there is a good mixture at the moment. There's still a long way to go for Germany. You look at their group, it's the perfect start for Hansi Flick. This qualifying group is a group that Germany should win and should win comfortably. But under Jogi Löw, they wouldn't have won it comfortably. But under Hansi Flick, I believe they will go on to win it comfortably.
And it's a team that looks nice and balanced now. Kimmich and Goretzka in midfield. Gnabry, Reus, Sane, Werner. You can even just by looking at 11, you know what they're trying to do. And you know they've got the commitment to that pace and that creativity going forward too. So even just in the selection, it just seems a lot more clearer than what was going on in the Jogi Löw era. So they're back in action on Thursday against Iceland, as I mentioned. That's the last of the qualifiers here, of course. And a lot of big nations in action, as I mentioned. So they're against Iceland. Belgium, they're against Belarus. All these games are 4:45 a.m. Australian Eastern Standard Time on Optus Sport. Poland against England, as I mentioned. Spain go to Kosovo. Italy host Lithuania, and Greece host Sweden. And that match that is important for Italy as well, Switzerland go to Northern Ireland.
And there's also a massive game going on in Group J, which is obviously the Germany game, is North Macedonia. You know, they found themselves in a decent position, really. Beating Germany was huge for them, obviously, before the Euros. Going to the Euros was an enormous occasion for them. So all the North Macedonian fans in Australia, they'll be up watching this game. It's a massive game for them against Romania. They get a result. They win that game. They can find themselves in the playoff position if other results go their way, which would be absolutely enormous for them.
So Germany, 12 points. Armenia, 10 points. Romania, 9 points. North Macedonia, 8 points. 4 points clear of Iceland. So fantastic stuff. Good to see them continuing the buzz from after the Euros.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Now, gents, when the international break finishes on Thursday, we are turning our attention to Saturday night and the return of the Premier League, because it really doesn't get actually much bigger than this. As I mentioned at the top, Cristiano Ronaldo was not involved in Portugal's game today. He arrived for duty, met Ole Gunnar Solskjaer at Manchester United's training headquarters to begin. Well, it's the homecoming. Can fairy tales come true? Is this going to work? How excited are you for Saturday night, midnight here in Australia against Newcastle United, Thomas? It's the homecoming. And football theatre doesn't get any bigger than this.
It's a fantastic story. I think, you know, for the Premier League, for Manchester United, you know, he's still a fantastic player. He can still make a massive difference. And, you know, you want to see, you know, definitely from my point of view, of, you know, the Premier League has got a special place in my heart. So to see the best players there and, you know, to see him going back, it's going to be a great occasion. You know, how does he fit in? You know, how does Solskjaer, you know, manage this? Will be a story to sort of stay on top of, because, you know, he is a big personality. You know, there has been managers that struggle to sort of at least get the best out of, or at least sort of get the squad to work around him. But yeah, you know, he's definitely adding another piece to United side that you know, now definitely have to aim for at least the top three, but maybe more.
What's the buzz in Spain, Mark? Obviously, England's beside itself with his return. We know he had possibly his peak years in Spain. Is there, particularly given that the La Liga doesn't have Ronaldo or Messi right now, has there been much focus on the move at all, or jealousy or anxiety over the fact that their league doesn't have these marquee men? Is anything worth noting from Spain?
Not really. I think more in Spain, what the talk about is how bad Barcelona's situation is, how bad a debt they're in. Is it going to be Real Madrid's title just to lose, which I probably think will be. Atletico will do their usual thing to try and upset, the big two, so to speak. And I think a lot of the talk is also, which has surfaced today, is about the fact that supposedly the European Super League is not dead, that it's still a chance. President of Barcelona, Laporte, has come out and said that it's not dead and it's going to be down to the courts in Europe to decide whether or not, you know, UEFA have any opportunity to quash their ideas of creating this European Super League.
Well, no wonder he's going to say that, because I was reading a story during the week that they're so broke, they're cutting the lights at training early to try save some money. So they need to keep the Super League idea alive, because they need to come up with a way to restart their financial structures.
1.2 billion euros in debt, Barcelona. I don't even understand how that's even possible in today's day and age. I don't even understand how a league, UEFA, would allow a club, any club, let alone a Barcelona, Real Madrid, anyone, to get in that sort of debt. I don't understand it. I mean, it makes a mockery of financial fair play. It's such a difficult one to understand.
It's the grossest mismanagement of one of the football's most iconic clubs that I've seen in the last 5 to 10 years, particularly when you can watch it externally like a train wreck, looking at their signings, and just you can just see that this is going to go down into a big, big, big black hole. But we digress, because right now we're talking about Manchester United, and they've got no issues because Ronaldo's shirts, Thomas, are running off the shelves. The first hour of CR7 back at Old Trafford, thanks to Edison Cavani, just slipping the number away, going and getting his Uruguay number. I think I read that the first hour was it beat the biggest day of online sales of Manchester United jerseys as soon as the number 7 with Ronaldo became available again. And it's a really good example of how, even at 36 years of age, I mean, you spoke about it last week, Schwartzy, you just had to make the move if you're United. It's a deal that transcends football. We're going to talk in a second about how it makes it work on the pitch, but off the pitch, it's already paying itself off for United in the first week.
Yeah, but I think, you know what, the thing is, that's been the easy target, isn't it, for everyone? For all the doubters, it's easy to go, it's just a financial decision. And don't get me wrong, I absolutely, 100% it's a financial decision. But it's not just a financial decision off the pitch. That's what makes it a no-brainer to me. That's what adds to the reason why it's a no-brainer, because off the pitch, it was always going to make a lot of sense. The question marks are there about how much of an influence, how big an effect will he have on the football pitch? And we talked about it last week. I, for one, believe he will have a big influence. And then that's an added bonus for them. So that will even generate more of a return. But then why does any club sign a player in the first place? You sign a player to generate money, to generate success, to create success. So, and that success is off the pitch and on the pitch. And that generally is directed by the success on the pitch. Some players can generate that interest, that revenue without even playing a single minute of football under their new terms and still generate a lot of money. And Ronaldo obviously is one of those exceptions. Messi, Beckham did it when he went to Real Madrid. Mm. And I think Cristiano Ronaldo, like I said before, no brainer. And he will be a success. And I'm so excited to see it as well. Like Thomas, I'm so excited to see it because I just hope it becomes now 4 horse race, maybe even 5 horse race, the entire season, and it's going to be tight and there's no one going to run away with it, and it's just going to be neck and neck all the way, and it's going to change on numbers of occasions, and players are going to be at each other and managers are going to be at each other, and I think it just sets itself up to be an incredible season.
So true. Where does Solskjaer go right though, Thomas? We know Ronaldo will score goals. He scored them in Italy for fun, but it didn't work for Pirlo and Sarri. How does Solskjaer make sure that Ronaldo scores goals for United and it works for Solskjaer and the team?
You know, I think history tells us, you know, that you need to keep him happy. I think that's the first sort of priority. He puts in the work. You know, he's a super professional. He wants to win. And he's going to inspire that team as well. And I think that's, you know, that's the feel you get out of United now, where they've been in the cauldron a little bit for the last 10 years. And suddenly now, at least off the pitch, they feel like they're getting restored to sort of the former glory. They still need the results and still need to win trophies. And that's the next step. So I think for Solskjaer is, you know, it's just rallying the players around him and get them to follow his example and his sort of winning mentality and get that culture built, because you can sort of see it coming. And I think maybe Ronaldo can just be that final piece, you know, to get that winning mentality week in and week out, that little bit of ruthlessness. I think that's what United at times have lacked a little bit. Maybe not as much as Arsenal, but you know, sometimes they've been a little bit inconsistent. And I think Ronaldo can add that consistency if Solskjaer plays his cards right.
Yeah, that's the challenge, isn't it, for Solskjaer to manage. Now he needs to manage the group of players, and obviously one of the biggest challenges is going to be managing Cristiano Ronaldo. And you mentioned there, David, before about Sarri and Pirlo. Sarri, we know from his time at Chelsea and even prior to that at Napoli, he's very set in his way, very pig-headed, and there's no other way than Sarri way. And that was always going to come to a head at some stage, and obviously it happened very quickly at Juve. Pirlo, a guy of zero experience as a manager, and I think found it very difficult at a time of massive change at a club at Juve and having to to try and regenerate. Whereas Ollie's been there for a while now. He's had periods of times where he's been able to settle. He's been able to bring in, get rid of players. And they're slowly creating a squad that is more than capable to compete. And if you look at them going forward, they've got an abundance of talent. Mm. So his challenge is going to be to find the right combinations. And Ronaldo has to be at that point end, the pointy end of that arrow. Whatever it is, he has to be in it. And very close behind it, it's going to have to be, you can see Bruno Fernandes, otherwise it's going to be, it seems to me like a player that is not going to be happy other than if he's playing every week and having a big part to play. Paul Pogba is the same. So he needs to manage all the sideshows. And that's going to be his biggest challenge, in my opinion. Getting the right combos and managing the sideshows. Pogba running out of contract. Keeping Ronaldo happy. Getting him scoring goals. Doing his thing. And having the right players around him to do a lot of the work that Ronaldo doesn't do anymore. Like, give him the ball. He will get you in the right position.
Jadon Sancho, get in the ball. Bruno Fernandes, get in the ball. Marcus Rashford, get in the ball. Paul Pogba, get in the ball. He's got his options. He does have his options.
He has.
But I also think that the whole media around it, I think with Ronaldo, there's going to be extra scrutiny. There's going to be extra storylines. And I think that's also the big job for Solskjaer is managing that narrative. Mm. Because, you know, if things start to go a little bit, if Ronaldo doesn't score, if you can see there's tactically a few issues, you know, how does he deal with that? I think that's also a big thing to look out for.
You know, it warms the heart. As a journalist, hearing one of my fellow pundits use the word narrative, that's I know the Gagger Pod's just, my cause is done now. That's brilliant.
I learned from the best, Dave. I learned from the best.
Hey, James, you both would have stared Ronaldo down in goal when he was back at United. I'd love to pick your brain on those experiences. He would have been the new kid on the block at the time, but. Well, I'm just going to sit back and listen to two keepers talking about their experiences now facing up to him when he was at his peak. Schwartzy, I mean,
yeah, so biggest we're talking... dive ever. Biggest yeah. dive ever at the Riverside. Got a penalty, got up and winked at his teammates. And I did. And I was literally about a foot away from him. And the referee's angle, he thought I'd fouled him. And everyone in the stadium pretty much saw that I didn't. And he won the penalty. The referee was adamant it was a penalty. I told him, you've messed up massively. You'll watch it on a replay and you will see how much of a cock-up you've done. He scores a penalty and we lose the game. And about two or three weeks later, we played another game and it was the same referee. And he came up to me and apologized and said to me, I've got home, my wife gave me an ear bashing, how bad a decision it was.
Who did he wink at, by the way? Was it sort of patronizing back to you or...?
No, it wasn't to me. No, it wasn't to me. One of his teammates it was a verification that he'd conned everyone.
What was the biggest threat, like as a keeper? Were you more on guard, ready for the rocket that could come from any place on the pitch? Was it to coach your defenders to make sure they didn't fall for one of his elaborate stepovers? Which was back at the day, that was the Ronaldo show, was the stepovers. What was the bigger anxiety at the time? Was it the excitement of the challenge, Thomas, of facing? At the time, a kid who was clearly destined to do some ridiculous things. What was the big preparation facing Ronaldo back in the day?
You know, I think it's just you got to be extra alert. There's the normal player where you can always sort of you know what's going to happen. You might be a step ahead all the time, but with Ronaldo, you might be the one that's trailing. And I think that's. You know, that's a difficulty. You know, it's the unknown. You know, obviously his strengths, but his thought process is just that much quicker than everyone else. So he sees things quicker than you might see things. You know, I must say, personally, you know, I struggled a little bit with his free kicks. you know, he definitely had the better of me there, you know, especially in the early days. Ridiculous the time that you had to react was difficult. He hammered a couple past me and And I probably didn't look that good.
Is it the speed, Tom? Is it the speed, the power, the accuracy? What's the difference?
No, it's a lot of things. You know, it's obviously the speed and then the technique, the way he strikes it, the movement he gets on the ball. And because you don't face it. Like at that time, I you don't face it in training. There's no one who can, you know, it's not like you can get a player out and said, just duplicate it. I'll get 10, 20, 30 shots and I've got this. It's something that you face only when he was on the pitch at that time. Drogba sort of developed a little bit of a similar striking technique from free kicks. But I think those first couple of years when he burst onto the scene and obviously had worked tremendously hard on the free kicks, it was definitely not something I had faced before. And definitely for a couple of seasons, I remember at least struggling a bit with the pace and picking it up quick enough. He scored a couple of goals that I probably would like to have back, looking back at it.
This weekend's a funny one because it feels like it's almost Ronaldo's homecoming as opposed to Manchester United v Newcastle. Was there a sense of circus Schwartzy when even then he obviously hadn't made the move to Madrid yet, but he was still a box office character developing? Was there the sense of occasion, theatre, hysteria when you were coming up against a player like that?
What I remember, though, is that he was there for, 6 years at United, and he played just short of 200 games for him, right? And he scored about 80-odd goals for him in that period of time. So even though it's a really good return, it's actually nothing compared to what he's done post then, you know? So I think it was, if I can remember correctly, it was probably the last year, 2 years of his time at United where you look at him and went, every time he played against him, you thought, well, this is going to be a hell of a challenge. You don't know what to do, and you have to expect anything. Players didn't know whether to engage with him or to drop off from him. They got turned inside out, got made a mockery of, and like Thomas was saying there, any free kicks from any distance, any direction, you had to be on your toes, and you had to expect the unexpected. So before that, he was this young kid who showed incredible glimpses or moments of talent and ability. And then he kind of, then things didn't quite, come off or something in a game. So there was that inconsistency. But certainly the last year and a half, 2 years was pretty frightening and difficult to come up against him. He was a brilliant, brilliant player. From my memory is that he went on to a different, well, not even a different level, probably another different five levels.
Planet.
When he went to Madrid. Yeah, a different planet when he went to Madrid. I mean, you look at his record at Madrid, I think appearances, like I'm just reading here, 292 appearances, 311 goals. I mean, it's phenomenal.
So with him back, what's par for Manchester United this year, boys?
Well, like I said before, like it's hard, it's hard to say, oh, now they're going to win the title, because you got obviously Chelsea who are looking extremely strong. You got Man City, you got the two teams that were in the Champions League final last year. So, it's a tall order, but he'll give them something extra. And that's why I'm saying it has to be top three now. Like they have to get ahead of Liverpool for sure. And then try to get in amongst the two favorites. I think that's where you want to see them. And then they got to try to win a trophy. They got to win League Cup, FA Cup, European. They have to win something, just for Solskjaer to get that monkey off his back and to really say that United, they're sort of at least getting close to their former glory.
If you look at it though, last season, United finished second. So they're a better side.
Yeah, but that was with half a season of Lampard, though. I think that's going to be a difference this year.
No, I agree with you. But in terms of, you look at just United themselves, the next step for United is to win the title. And surely Sancho, Ronaldo are adding to that ability, that possibility of winning the title.
Possibility, but I still think defensively, I don't think they're as good as the two others.
No, they're not. We'll but see. I don't think they were. I don't think they were last season. I didn't think they were. They were second last season. You know, if you talk about it in terms of league position, I thought Liverpool, Chelsea were far better than them, really. But obviously, Chelsea over time weren't consistent over the course of the season. The season table doesn't lie. So 38 games, Man United deserve to be second. But in terms of actual squad depth and ability, we all know Liverpool had massive injury crisis anyway. So to them finish third was remarkable. United, new season, new players, everyone else is the same. Everyone else has strengthened. Liverpool have strengthened without really bringing in a lot of players, but have strengthened because of the fact is that they've had all these players come back. Oh, I mean, I think the gap between City and Manchester City and the others has narrowed because City haven't really, you know, apart from Grealish, I don't think they've necessarily, they've added obviously, but have they added on last season? In terms of league position, I mean, or points, even more points. No, I don't think they have. And I don't think City have quite got the balance right with Grealish on their side. Will that come? Yeah, probably. Will it be enough time to win the league? You're pretty brave to bet against City. But like I said earlier on, what's the path for Man United? I think United have to finish a bare minimum second is a par for me.
Okay.
Bare minimum. Yeah.
Everyone else might have got more competitive, but they've strengthened. So technically speaking.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and also they've got to win a trophy. I think they need to win a trophy. I mean, that's something. I mean, Ollie said it a couple of seasons, or last season he said it, you know, winning trophies is not how you judge someone's success. Since when? You know, since when?
But, you know, you.
of course, you know, and I think everyone gets judged. All managers get judged on their success, how they fit, how many trophies they win. What, you know, we're talking about the top echelons, and that's what Man United are and need to be, and have to have a manager that demands and expects winning silverware. And there has to come a point. And I'm sure it is already at that point where United are demanding silverware. Well, they've had progression. There's no doubt about it. Certainly had progression. They couldn't have got any worse, could they?
Pressure's on. Pressure's on. You just can't wait to see it. It just adds to the narrative, Thomas, of the season ahead, and it's going to be absolutely brilliant. Gents, we're going to touch on the weekend ahead in a second. I just want to touch on a few of the big news items because there might not have been any Premier League, but there's been a lot going on in the world of football. And I want to play a quick game and finish this sentence with you. And I want to start with, Thomas, a World Cup every 2 years is?
Can I say too much? it's ridiculous for me. I think it's. I think there's been plenty of things said. You know, I think it's saturation. I think you want to keep... you know, want to keep the World Cup special. And then where do you fit the Euros in? And we talked about it during the summer, like how great is the Euros? They're you know, at times, maybe even better than the World Cup because it's the quality is so high. And, you know, again, how do you fit the schedule in of clubs and players and you know, the injuries and, you know, again, I think it's a little bit like the Super League. You know, it's a money grabbing thing. You know, if we can get the World Cup, you know, every 2 years, you know, it's more money in our coffers. And I don't think it's the route to go down. And it seems, you know, a lot of people at least is on my side in that argument.
Schwartzy, there's an argument that, I believe that, you know, you don't want to make the jewel and the crown. Well, the value of a jewel is they're rare and you don't want to have it more often than it does. It decreases the value. But the argument from Arsene Wenger, who's supposedly the champion of it, is it actually, he's arguing from the football reasons. And of course, no one can be naive enough, Thomas, to think that there's not a financial and a commercial reason to it. For a football reason, he's arguing that you can actually tidy up the messed up calendar by getting rid of international windows, less qualifiers, and actually the tournament doesn't lose its gravitas because of how often it is, because it will still be high quality. So actually you might have clubs going, oh, it's not a bad idea because you're actually keeping our players more often and have them traveling around the world for qualifiers less often. That's the footballing argument. But I don't know whether that has you swinging any differently to Thomas there, Mark.
Well, I was involved in some of the discussions with Arsene Wenger and a whole group of other players, ex-players, coaches, regarding this very subject, and also the number of international breaks per calendar year. And do you reduce those numbers and increase the actual time of the fewer breaks, the fewer times away? And the World Cup, the very first thing when we had the discussion and that was talked about, was my reservation was that about devaluing the actual World Cup itself. Having it too often is too much for me. Then there was a suggestion, and there were a group of players that put a suggestion for that maybe once every 3 years is a possibility. And you know, I'm not one to say that you can't change things. I think you should explore the ideas of potentially what could make things better. You've got to do your due diligence. You've got to put it out there. And apparently, one of the reasons why this has also been pushed or has certainly been taken to this level is that I think it's 166 nations out of the 200 and something registered with FIFA have voted in favor of exploring the ideas and what the pros and cons may be for holding a World Cup every 2 years. One of the other issues I have with it is that the zero consultation with other federations, i.e. UEFA, for example, Africa, all the different nations regarding their own tournaments. Having a World Cup every 2 years, what happens to all the rest of them? Mm. Where do they fit their tournaments in?
What happens to women's World games? Cups, women's Euros,
absolutely. Events? Absolutely. When you go on to the discussion about international breaks, and we currently have 5 a year, reducing those down to 3, but having overextended period of time, as a player that traveled a long way for 20 odd years, I actually don't think that's a bad idea. Having an international break for maybe 3 weeks or 4 weeks, only twice a year plus the June mm-hmm. period of time, I think makes a lot of sense. It's obviously people just trying to get their heads around it. I mean, the first thing people said was, well, who's going to pay for that? Club's going to have to pay for players being away for a month at a time. Well, you're paying that anyway. You're paying that broken over 5 breaks over the season rather than 3. Mm. There's no difference to me. And there are pros and cons with it because you may have a period of time where a player will be injured for that month and therefore the club don't actually lose that player and that player stays in their club. The national team misses out on them. There may be a case that they go away and get injured, which can always happen. So I think there's certainly a valid reason to explore reducing the number of breaks internationally and potentially extending the length of time players are away.
As a hypothetical, which is a very much a hypothetical, but if we travel back to 2005, where it meant so much to you and to Australia when Australia qualified because of how elusive it had been. And for those in 2001 and 97, it was that idea of, oh, it's another 4 years. That's a lifetime away. And it meant more and more and more and more. Could you see that carrot or that sweetener or that what it meant to a player and a nation might be diminished if you go, well, we'll get another crack in 2 years and there's more teams
yep.
and we might host
definitely.
It and da-da-da-da-da.
No, definitely. 100%. That goes without saying. Absolutely. I mean, the other argument that was put forward during that discussion was that there are so many players that may only get one opportunity to play at a World Cup because it's every 4 years. But if you take it to 2 years, they get more opportunities. See, I'm not one in favor of that. I'm one that, like you're saying, the fact is that it's every 4 years, the build-up, the meaningfulness of that tournament is so immense. Would we have had the scenes that we had for the Uruguay qualification games in 2005? Probably not if it was every 2 years. I still have enormous amounts of reservations about hosting a World Cup sooner than every 4 years. I still think 4 years is the ideal time. I'm still very much on board with that.
Was that chat for this cycle of headlines with Wenger, or was that an older discussion?
Well, it was. When was it? In the last couple of months. So okay. Yeah, it was all to do with this whole process now of, because part of the thing of Arsene Wenger is what he's been doing is, which I think has been great. He's been all inclusive. He's been inviting a whole lot of ex players and coaches to be involved in discussions on various points. whether it's to do with, you know, all aspects of the game, development of the game and so forth. And a lot of the conversation has been really, really interesting. And he's very open to people giving their own opinions and actually even having direct contact with him to put forward any other opinions that you may have, discussions that you may want to have. And he's very much open to even having an individual conversation with you if you have an idea of how you feel that something could change.
Professor of new football ideas. This one is not going to go away, get the sense.
I'm a big fan of Arsene Wenger. I think he's an incredible manager. He was an incredible tactician ahead of his time. I think he's an incredible gentleman. And yes, you may disagree with his opinion at times. You may not like the ideas that he comes up with, but you need people like him to push the boat. You need people like him to come up with other ideas, to ask questions and ask uncomfortable questions and create a debate, because that's the only way I think we can potentially evolve the game if need be, or we can confirm that actually the current structure of whatever it is, whether it's a World Cup, whether it's a Euros, whatever it is the best it can possibly be at this moment in time, according to a whole variety of different people's opinions.
Mm. Well, Thomas, the mess in inverted commas of World Cup qualifying, so to speak, sort of got seen in South America this week with quarantine rules and moving people around and Premier League clubs not sanctioning their players. And of course, I'm talking about Argentina against Brazil, which got cancelled because Argentina's players had bluffed on their form and said that they hadn't been in the UK and Spurs had given permission to some players and not other players to go. And now we're talking about sanctions from FIFA for Argentina and Brazil, and Tottenham looking at sanctions for a couple of their players for not listening to them. And we're talking about what's the other thing that's happening right now? The Premier League not knowing whether the players that weren't released, the clubs that held their players back, whether they'll get fined for not releasing the players. It's a mess. So I ask to you, Spurs players ignoring club wishes to travel to South America should?
Yeah, in my book, it should be respected. You know, I've been in a boat. I know how much it means to play for your country. You know, we just talked about the World Cup, you know, how elusive it is, how much it means, not just to players, but to the country, to the fans. You know, you play your heart out for your club, but you know, where your real heart lies for a lot of players is with your country. So, you know, I get where they're from, you know, and I get the situation, you know, that Tottenham, you know, and every other club, you know, they don't want to release the players because it's again, political problems, injury problems, all these things go hand in hand with international football. But, you know, I'm not going to sit here and dish those players that went because, you know, they want to get to the World Cup. And again, it's a game against Brazil. You know, who doesn't want to play in that? And you want to keep your place in the national side. You know, it's a mess, as you said. You know, there's so many angles to this. And that this is what this pandemic has done. It's yep. thrown so many spanners in the works. And, you know, we don't know where to stand at any given stage.
Yeah, it's the international. It's more the fact that the logistics and the rules and the COVID protocols are a real mess with people traveling around the world right now. It's Buendia and Martinez from Argentina, who I think were allowed to go, but Tottenham didn't want Romero and Lo Celso to go as well. And they're the two that Tottenham are looking at going. You might be in a bit of strife.
Did Lucas Moura go for Brazil?
I don't know. They're the four names I've seen. That particularly, so two are allowed to go and two Tottenham didn't want to go. And they're the ones that said they hadn't been in the UK when clearly, obviously they had been. And there's been, and Argentina claimed that the rules, they were playing by the rules from Copa America. The rules have changed in Brazil since the Copa America. So it is a big mess. And we'll have to just stand by and watch what happens in the coming days in terms of disciplinary action when the game gets rescheduled, because it was a World Cup qualifier. A big, big, big mess. A little bit tidier, Schwartzy, is the Socceroos. 10 straight World Cup qualifying wins. 1-0 over Vietnam, following up the performance from China. Graham Arnold's side are actually in a really decent spot.
100%. We had a conversation about this off air, right? And I say to all the haters out there, to all the people that dish out the stick about the performance of the Socceroos, whether it was this morning, last night, your time, you know, over the last couple of weeks, most of these people have no idea. And they're just haters and they're people who want to complain about everything, because to play in the conditions the Socceroos have played in, particularly the last two games, and also the mini little tournament they played in Kuwait, to win all those games cannot be underestimated how difficult a time that was. The humidity and the heat is ridiculous. The Socceroos played against Vietnam in 29 degrees heat, right? Which people go, well, in Australia, 29 degrees is not very hot. It's hot, but it's not over the top. And you're right. It's not over the top. It's doable. But if you add to the mix 72% humidity, I after the game checked, it was probably about 2 or 3 hours after kickoff, the temperature and the humidity in Vietnam at the time. And it was a general thing of Vietnam. It came up as 92% humidity. For the average mere mortal who don't travel, who don't leave their comfort of their armchair watching a game of football where there's a nice sunshine in the background or it seems like it was a nice day, you have no understanding of what it's like to actually, let alone step foot out of an aeroplane or step foot into a country that has humidity and a temperature of that combination, let alone have to go out actually doing any exercise and then go do it at an elite level. And yes, they are professional and everything else, but you've got to understand what that takes and what sort of levels of effort are needed to perform at that level. And add to the mix, the pitch was terrible. Against an opposition who are acclimatized and play week in, week out, and live in those in that climate, then that puts a little bit of perspective into it. But you still never know because you've never set foot in that country and never experienced it. But unfortunately, there'll always be those people out there that love to jump on the bandwagon and love to give, you know, the team stick. I take my hat off to them. I think it was a tremendous performance, regardless of whether or not the actual overall performance wasn't great. The result is amazing, and it puts them in a great position. And I think you have to give them a lot of credit. I think Graham Arnold said it after the game very well. Yes, we could play a lot better, 100%. But the attitude and the effort the players put in was exceptional. And I think, again, that is all we can ask for. And on top of it, they got the result. So it was the perfect scenario for them.
Yeah, in these qualifying campaigns, I remember, was it for 2010, which was slightly anticlimactic for you guys, but that was the mark of a really good campaign, which was that you did the 1-0s in Vietnam and you weren't left scrambling till the final day to try and get it through.
I mean, we played in Bahrain and we were horrendous. We were terrible, but the conditions were extreme. We won, I think, Mark Bresciano scored with almost the last kick of the game. We won 1-0 and we should never in a million years. We were lucky to actually win the game. We would have been lucky to get a draw. And the campaign seemed easy because we went through and didn't concede a goal until the last game against Japan at home, where we won 2-1, didn't lose the game. And everyone went, oh, well, it's easy. It's too easy for them. Well, we made it look easy, but it actually wasn't easy. It was incredibly difficult. But because of the professionalism and the effort and the commitment from the players, we made it look easy. And that's what these guys are doing right now. They're making it look a lot easier than it actually is. And half the time that's to your detriment because people underestimate it and people just think, well, they look at their ranking Vietnam and go, they're 94 in the world. How come the Socceroos only 1-0? And when we get to the World Cup, we're going to get spanked. And that's just ridiculous. You know, judge them in an environment that's suitable to play football regularly and these guys are able to play and perform at the highest level. Then judge them. Don't judge them in these games because these games, judge the result. That's the most important thing right now.
It's an interesting... sorry, Thomas. Yes, go.
Yeah, no, Sporty, you know as well that when you played international football for a long time, you know that there's just certain places, and it happens in Europe. It's probably more extreme, you know, for Australia because the conditions are so different. But in Europe, you know, I've been to Armenia, Azerbaijan. You know, these are the places where, you know, ability goes out the window. It's about the fight. It's about the conditions. It's about just grabbing the 3 points and getting the hell out of there, and this is what people don't understand, you know. So it's part of the game, and you know, take the 3 points, be happy, and Australia, like the Socceroos, are in a great position in that group, you know, sitting top and again in control. So what is there to be not happy about?
I add to the mix is a pandemic. So add to the mix the conditions, the restrictions that everyone has to go through. That is another level altogether.
You got Matthew Lecky, who's the, I think the captain, and he's sat in Melbourne and obviously doesn't want to travel because of the quarantine. You know, so that's just just one small part that's not in their favour.
And against China, who had been in camp, the Socceroos really had the old, you know, get together, throw in camp, couple of training sessions, and get out there. And I guess the last thing on this, Schwartz, is we've spoken about the professionalism and the ability to overcome duress. But actually, in patches, probably more against China than against Vietnam, this team that's getting assembled is actually showing pockets of actually being able to play some really decent football and have a few different options available with the development of your Hrustic's and Rogic's return to form as well. Suddenly guys like Aaron Moy, who had been indispensable previously, they're having to come off the bench. There's just a few little choices that are appearing, and that can only be positive over the next few months and years.
Again, you know, you've got to give credit to Graham Arnold for putting trust in these players to come up with a different scenario, different solutions, different tactics, not afraid to mix it up. I mean, I think, you know, with Ange with the national team, the one criticism you could direct towards him was he didn't have a plan B at times, played the same way every time. And look, he even struggled in games away from home. They drew with Thailand 2-2. There was two penalties that, Miller Jednak scored. And they were lucky to get those penalties. But they played one way and one way only, and they almost came unstuck. Graham Arnold has the flexibility. Listen, ultimately, you can only get judged on the games that you're playing. We talked about it earlier on about Denmark cruising through their group. They're cruising through their group because they deserve to, and they've played so well, and they've made the group look easy. And yes, on paper, people will go, they should win the group. But should and doing it are two different things. You've got to, you know, you've got to live the scenario. You've got to work through the different environments. You've got to perform. Players, injuries, come and goes, tactics, whatever it is, you've got to get the results. You've got to get those 3 points and move on. So you've got to judge the Socceroos on qualification. Get out of the group. We saw last time round, we had to go through a playoff. You know, we almost missed out on going to the World Cup in Russia. So you've got to get there firstly. Get through this stage. Then judge them on the next stage. Don't just judge them on this stage by virtue of qualification. Yes, the performance can always come, but if you're winning and not performing necessarily well, that's also not a bad position to be in. Be far worse if you're playing really well and not winning games and don't qualify. Be far worse. I know where I'd rather be.
Yeah, it's good stuff. It's good to see the Socceroos back in action. Good to see them putting themselves in the headlines. Good to see them setting records, 10 straight wins in qualification too. So that can only be positive. And let's hope, there's a little bit of hope, that we might be able to see them on home soil in October as well. And the side deserves that home ground advantage. You know, to go through qualifying, even to play in neutral territory, that is a distinct disadvantage. So let's hope that comes into the mix.
And finally, that 10 games in a row. You know, this is a squad of players that supposedly, you know, yes, there's a new generation of players coming through. There's some players that are hitting some form again. But a squad that is far less talented than many previous squads. And none of those previous squads and squads that I was in were able to do that, 10 qualifiers in a row. So you cannot underestimate how good of accomplishment and achievement that is.
Yeah, well said. Well said. And it's great at the time to put the Socceroos back in the map because they've been through sheer logistics, not played for nearly a year. It is great to see them back on the map. We've been talking and talking and talking and talking and talking. Before we finish off, we've got to talk about the Premier League coming up on the weekend because we spoke about Ronaldo, but you know what? There's 9 other games and 19 other teams that are going to be involved on the weekend. It all kicks off on Saturday night with Crystal Palace hosting Tottenham. Top of the league, Tottenham buzzing. There's some great stuff on the OptiSport app if you'd like to read a little bit more around what Nuno has done to get them to the top of the table over the opening weeks. Goal Rush on Saturday night. Goal Rush is back in all its glory. Watford against Wolves, Brentford against Brighton, Arsenal against Norwich, Manchester United against Newcastle, Southampton against West Ham, Leicester City against Manchester City, 2:30 a.m, Chelsea against Aston Villa, and then it gets bigger on Monday again, Leeds against Liverpool, 1:30 a.m, Australian Eastern Standard Time. That is one of the great rivalries, and the round finishes on Tuesday with Everton against Burnley. So much to pick apart. We will do it briefly. Thomas, we know we're going to be watching Manchester United Newcastle. We've spoken for ages on that. We're not going to talk about that. What else catches your fancy this weekend?
You know, again, a big test for Manchester City, I think, going to Leicester. You know, Leicester have been a bit up and down. And City, yes, great result against Norwich. But, you know, where do they stand? You know, they've had trouble with Leicester in the past, and Leicester will sit back and try to hit them on the counter. So I think that's going to be an interesting game. There'll definitely be goals in that. And then, yeah, obviously Leeds, Liverpool, I think, you know, a classic in Leeds with the fans there. You know, it's going to be a fantastic atmosphere. And again, another big test for Liverpool to see where they stand, because, you know, we know what Leeds is about.
What about for you, Mark?
Yeah, Leeds, Liverpool's a massive one, isn't it? Interesting to see. We know what Leeds will do. Bielsa, his way of playing. Plan A, and that's it. That's Leeds United. You know, so they've got that. They do it normally very, very well. Big challenge for Liverpool. I mean, Leicester, Man City again, like Thomas was saying, huge game. And it's going to be a test for Leicester as well. And also Manchester City to see where they are and whether or not they start to really hit the ground running. I'm also intrigued to see how Arsenal respond. Mm-hmm. Being away, international break, obviously losing their first three games of the season, playing at home to Norwich City. It's a 1,000% must win.
Yeah.
If there's such a thing.
Well, the headline from the weekend could be from this game. Simple. If it's not an Arsenal win, this game outside of Ronaldo will be the headline.
I would think so, yes. So yeah, everything's on the line for Mikel Arteta come this weekend with Arsenal against Norwich for me.
Interesting that it is at home too. So the fans and the atmosphere, the reception that they get is going to be telling for where the club's fans are in terms of their faith in Mikel Arteta. But you made a great point, Tom.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
About this Leeds Liverpool game happening in a packed Elland Road, like it just changes the dynamic. But it's actually at a really good time for Leeds too. Like they're in that little phase at the moment where everyone's sort of wondering, are they going to continue to build on last year? Are they going to have a few more challenges? They've just signed Dan James. I think this is going to be a fabulous little opportunity for them to show where they're at.
Yeah, for sure. You know, again, there's no better opportunity. You know, again, it's going to be a cracking atmosphere. Elland Road, where both me and Swartzy have played there. It's such a tight ground, old school. The fans there have been dying to be back. So, yeah, and Liverpool, as you said, the rivalry, yeah, they'll cause some problems.
Gents, I think that's all we've got time for today. We'll talk more about the Premier League. We'll dissect all those games in next week's edition of the Gag and Pod. There's a lot to look forward to there as ever. I mean, what's interesting now that you mentioned how tight it is at the top, Schwartz, a game like Chelsea-Aston Villa is a test that Chelsea must get through to make sure that everyone's maintaining that pace. So you've got that little change of dynamic now where dropping points or dropping points in a few games could become something that snowballs because the pressure up the top is going to get really, really, really tight. There's a lot to look forward to on the weekend. And as ever, the Optusport app will have you covered, whether it's through words or through vision or through highlights or through replays. You will have it all there. And we'll be back on Tuesday next week to wrap it all up for you once again. Boys, thank you for your insights today. As ever, it's been great fun. Held the fort in Bridgie's absence. But I think, looking at the clock, we got through. If Bridgie was here, we've been going for 3 hours. Good stuff as ever.
We still miss Bridgie.
We do.
Hang on, do we?
I'm glad you said it.
Boys, thanks so much for your time. We'll do it all again next week. And to everyone out there as ever, and more than ever with the Premier League back this weekend, until the next episode of the Gang Pod, enjoy your football.